Nice to meet you all. Good morning for some of you, I guess.
Good morning.
I hope you had a good night yesterday and a good party. So we're going to start slowly with the workshop. First, we're going to have a very quick presentation about how it's going to go down and what are the topics that we're going to discuss and what the reports are, although we want to open as many questions as possible so that we are then forming groups of people, teams, sort of, and then addressing the four topics and opening up as many questions and learning as much as possible from all of us. I think that this is quite a diverse group, so we all have different types of knowledges. And if we make it a bit interdisciplinary, I think this is going to be quite great for us. So yeah, my name is Anya, Anya Baik. I'm a lawyer. I am actually focused on the international law and the space law. But more or less, I'm working in a blockchain space as well. So we're trying to open up an unlock company. This is Marina, my partner. She's going to talk about herself by herself, so I'm not going to be talking on her behalf. So yeah, we're actually kind of finding what the proper legal entity for DAOs might be. This is what we work on in Unlock. Finding what the right jurisdiction might be and what are the legal obstacles on our way to create the DAOs and to create a good environment here. Also talking to some regulators and finding out a lot of stuff here. So yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Marina. I'm very happy to see you all here. A lot of familiar faces. So we are also happy to have two facilitators with us that are experienced facilitators, Max from GeekOv and Felipe from DevStack. We are also part of DGov, especially Anya, and she is a founding member of DGov, and we learned a lot from this community, which is actually organizing events and working on a strategy for governance for different blockchains. Maybe you can also say a word about DGov.
You're right. DGov connects more than 500 researchers now in different fields, from political science to technology, try to assign get cross-functional people together to move these complex issues forward.
I mean, we have been seeing a lot of different presentations and panels, and I heard when there were questions, really tough questions asked, they say, it depends on the governance we are going to adopt. So every time we're talking about governance, but we don't know what this is actually. And this is also the idea of our workshop. So we were thinking, okay, what would we like to discuss? And if we think about governance, forking is the extreme event that could happen actually. And then we were asking, how much do we know about forks? Who is talking about forks? Who is preparing plans to for the readiness for forks? This was our additional idea. So as we said, we have a really short presentation and then we're going to work in groups. After that, also the groups are going to have a presentation about their work. So the method, we were thinking of having a method where you might be used to, for example, different types of competitions. One of those is a moot court. Anya can tell more about this.
Yeah, so I don't know how many of you read the description of the workshop. Firstly, it was envisioned more or less like a moot court. It's a legal thing. You go on a competition and you present the arguments for both of the parties in order to convince the judges. And what I like about it so much is that the judges are usually the real judges. So it's not an imaginary case. It's actually the real law that we use and the real judges are in front of you. So whatever the case is, they are actually getting the knowledge on how a case in the future might be solved using the laws that we have. And right now we might be imagining a case for a fork, but what we have is real. So whatever scenario we are going to have, whomever we are going to speak to, it might actually be used somewhere in the future.
And what is really important about moot courts is the argumentation. So if we are taking like a step, we're saying, okay, we want to do that, but this is the argument why we need to do that or why this is important. And we really like to work on that in the groups.
So we're not really going to go with a moot court because this is a smaller group and we're not really having a case in front of us. So we don't moot court. We usually have a couple of months of preparation.
Yeah.
So we only have 2 hours, so we'll drop that idea and we're just going to form groups of people and have a discussion like we're used to.
But still using the argumentation part. And having a presentation, maybe challenging each other with questions. So the issue is the fork. What are forks? When are they happening? How are we reacting to it? Who are the stakeholders in this fork ecosystem? So we can tell you a little bit about the history, Anya.
So what forks are, it's basically just the speed of the protocols. We have different types of forks, but we want you actually to, and us together, to think about new types of forks. So it might not really be just soft forks and hard forks, it actually might be more relevant to think about what are the reasons for forks, and then create new types of forks or new taxonomy for forks based on those reasons that we are having the issues. So the history of forks, probably everyone here is familiar with the DAO fork, which was pretty much the bug. And when you go through a history of all forks, you see that there is different reasons, and the bug is one of the reasons. So the bug actually functions like a flashback. In order to actually solve that fork, we are kind of in the whole community creating a defense mechanism. So we are communicating how we're going to fork so that we prevent the hacking, so that we prevent the malicious abuse of the code. But all the forks are not really necessarily based on something that is maliciously conducted on the code. It might as well be just an upgrade of the code. And these are the hot forks that we're now seeing presenting and the upgrade of the code in Ethereum. So yeah, this is actually what types we were thinking of. You might have a client contingent, which is because of the bug or the hack. And then you have spin-offs, which is just the altcoin. So somebody copy-pastes the code. And this is all open source. So there's questions like for lawyers, whether this should be patented, or are there any breaches of the IP rights and stuff like that.
So we are talking here about governance. We don't want to go into technical details, but everybody, or at least it's really easy to copy paste the code, but we would like to think about the governance. So if we're doing, for example, a spin-off of a coin, what governance is included here? Are we talking to the community? How are we communicating with the community? Also, the opening of DEF CON, we were hearing about Byzantinium, and they were also saying, we need to focus on communication to our stakeholders. So exchanges, different other organizations. This is like a plan for the next years for our blockchain. So how are we communicating that internally and also externally to the whole community?
Okay, so this is something that NATO came up with, or the political science in the international field of law. Readiness action plan is pretty much the plans that governments are having when the shit goes down. So when there is, for example, a threat or an impact on the nation state, the NATO and all the international communities are actually having readiness plans. So how they're going to react on that threat. And what is happening with forks, if it's not really a community thing, if it's not really just an upgrade, then we have to be ready as much as possible. So DEF CON has a B, America has DEF CON with an F, and they have different stages. And according to how bad the threat is, that actually creates the stage, and that creates the reaction plan for them. They actually have all the readiness action plans prepared ahead, so that people know how to react appropriately and as fast as possible and be as efficient as possible. So on the next slide, we actually have what it should be all about, to have as possible swift and friendly responses that we can create, and then that we have a proper deterrence and defense policy mechanism. So for that to happen, we actually first need to discuss what types of forks we have, what are the issues that we are addressing, what are the obstacles, is it actually good to fork or not? This is something that Vlad proposed. But we also formed a couple of other questions that we might want to address. And we have four different types of groups that we want to create, but since there's not so many of us, we can also go into two types of groups. So if we go to, so this is just a picture that presents that we want to collaborate in teams and have a discussion ready. So we're going to have two facilitators, let's form two groups, and then let's just discuss all these topics. Maybe we can even merge two of the groups together. So we have four of them. One is type of the fork, motivation for forks, whether to fork or not to fork. And then we have fork communication, which is pretty much relevant for the governance. and the communication of the community, and then the four technicalities. So if anyone feels ready to talk about the code and the technical aspects of the fork, then this is pretty much the group to go with.
So we see that here in the group we know some people, but we don't know all of you. We were also thinking of having different groups in, and also like ideas interacting with each other from the legal point of view, communication point of view, or technical point of view. You can also form groups if you would like to just talk to lawyers or just to tech people, developers. We are very flexible in how to form those groups, but those are some suggestions from our side. So we also discussed with Vlad, and he was urging us to ask a very important question.
Yeah, we actually covered it already.
Okay, so
yeah, I can read it out loud.
Yeah.
I think it's better if we just form two groups. So one would be types of the groups and motivations for the groups. I think these two are very connected to each other. Regarding on the motivation of a fork, that might actually create a taxonomy. So we're just going to merge those, and we have 2 hours, so don't worry about time. I think we have more than enough time to actually go through all these questions. And then we can merge the fork communication with the fork technicalities. Depends on the technicalities of the fork that might actually direct on how we communicate and how, which tools we use and who are the stakeholders that are actually communicating the fork. So if you feel okay to that, let's just make 2 post-its, 2 groups, and then we split into 2 groups. We have 2 facilitators. They're going to take care of the timing. Also, they're going to have all the questions presented in front of them. So we might have you guys to ask the questions. And then at the end of it, somebody, if we have a volunteer, can just take the notes, and then we have a discussion, and we go later on discussion by what we think are the outcomes.
If the group is smaller, we can also discuss in one group, and it really depends on what you're interested in and what would you like to discuss. I mean, do you have an idea? Have you been asking yourself about those questions? Not really. I mean,
lots of questions actually. I mean, I think because the communication is not quite standardized. There's a lot of questions about what's actually happening. How it works today. This is just, obviously it's a good process to just say, yeah, we need to do this technical upgrade, and then it's actually for, doesn't really feature.
So, hey, do you think about just forming a circle, and then letting all the questions together?
I mean, when we're discussing this, do you feel that you have enough information about forks and what's actually happening?
Both of the BTC, BCH fork and the ETC, ETH fork. that in both those cases you ended up creating something that was more than that, right? And with ETC, you brought in a bunch of people who haven't been into that into Ethereum before, but you know, felt like it just didn't look interesting to them. And then with BTC, BTH, you certainly the market price of the combined thing was greater than the previous market price before, at least in that era. And then we had at least the era when BCH and BSV split off, and that had the opposite effect, that it just, I guess, kind of diluted the community.
I would like to compliment that observation with that I totally even don't know about that. And that there was this different perspective on the force of what they do to the community and to the promise of immutability of smart contracts and so on, that has nothing to do with the resulting market prices, but is almost just like, okay, it's a PR element that is divorced though from the value of the currency on the chain. But it's just like, okay, did we now ruin the actual promise? Right? There were a lot of people on the fence that were not vocal that felt like, well, maybe the fork should not happen.
Speaking specifically about Ethereum now.
Yeah, the first fork, and then Bitcoin is always more vocal.
Because you've got kind of two decision points as a user, right? When there's a if there's a change to the system that you're using, firstly there's the question of, do you actually support the change or not? But then if the change goes ahead and happens, the question is then, do you then support it to the extent of supporting a minority branch? And do you actually think that it's worth actually having that division over it?
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide?
Well, right. So part of it, I guess, is just whether it's something that's fundamental to you as part of the value of the thing, right? So for the ETC guys, you know, if you've got something that can be tampered with by some social process, then for them, there's just no point in even being part of that. That's just not something that's interesting. And the same, I think, was true with the BTC and BCH fork, that as far as the BCH guys were concerned, the whole thing they were trying to do was build cash for everybody. And if you then say, okay, we're not going to scale this, you know, scaling is not very important to us. I know there are arguments about, okay, we're going to scale a different way, but at least in the short term, people, you know, it was a community that wasn't really interested in using this as money for everybody. Then, as far as most of the BCH guys are concerned, that's just not even something they're interested in doing. So even though they lose this huge network effect, they lose the brand, they lose all the stuff that Bitcoin has, but for them it's just not worthwhile being in Bitcoin. They'd rather have their own thing, even if it does turn out to be a nice one.
So in a general sense, what I'm hearing is that at the heart of a fork, be it a technical issue or not, or a bug or a hack, in the end, the main reason for the fork is a disagreement or a divergence on principles and values.
At least until the BSV one. I think the BSV one's more of this use of personalities. And if you're doing, and what we're doing when we have a dispute like this is basically, I mean, it's politics. And once you're doing politics, then obviously, as well as values, you have personalities and factions. And,
I would like to disagree with that proposition, because I think in the end, it was always just about money, nothing else.
Just
it was mining interests, like miners, being a bit behind the scenes in Bitcoin. And in Ethereum, it was just a core community having invested in the DAO. Mm-hmm. And it would not have been them, the fork would not have happened.
But what about the priority? What about the priority?
Well, it's just not enough of the core community involved, because it's just a couple of people that cost their money, right? And
so
ETC had proven that was very costly to do this, because that was not expected at all. Right? Everybody thought everybody was going to go over. But still, you have vested interests, like somebody lost money or stands to gain money, or somebody's losing power or stands to gain power, the miners that in Bitcoin. And I think actually the people who are interested in the principle usually are pretty silent and don't really meddle in the battles. Principles are not driving the force or not. I would say that probably on a chain that doesn't have money as a token on the chain, you wouldn't have this kind of debates and politics about forks.
Okay, so it's more, in your point of view, it's more pure game theory.
No.
No, just money.
Game theory is something wonderful.
How is the BTC initiated fork driven by money theory?
There's a lot about the power of miners. how you see that history. It was a lot about people behind the scenes, pulling strings, making sure stuff goes through, goes on through, because it's better for the established cashing power. So, and that's not necessarily what comes up first, but I think it's little people about that.
So in the case of Bitcoin, it's very obvious that like the value of the network is money. And I mean, it's like the community and people working together to generate it, but like it's in the money. Like for example, in some network where like value would be just like workforce or something like that, I expect that this would be the at the heart of, you know, all the debates and stuff. And I think that more than money, it's like where value accrues, and I don't know, like, because in the end, like, it just takes that, is there, like, no stakes at all on anything, obviously, like, I'm not going to need governance to go, you know, to decide on what the, and here, like, in this precise case, like, yeah, in the early days, the stakes are, looks like money and stuff. I don't know, like, maybe, I don't know, maybe money,
maybe Bitcoin is about money.
Like, value, I would say value more than money.
Yeah, but there are three different things involved, right? The one is, like, Bitcoin as a payment tool. The other is people having Bitcoin. And then there's people making Bitcoins by mining. And I'm not sure what's being pretended is being the cause for the fork was actually always why the fork was pushed for. So, and that was a big political game, but I don't think it would ever be so politically charged and so loud if it was just about technology.
So would you say that we kind of need a new taxonomy, since, I mean, we are already talking about the reasons for the fork. There might be money incentives, value incentives, there might be reasons like bugs and just upgrades. I wouldn't necessarily say that the forks are happening for the money reasons, but it's just about the upgrade of the code.
So when the people that are deciding the forks at the end of the day are the miners, so then they're driven by money ultimately, because they invest all this capital in like mining equipment. So, like, but the developers, their reasoning is different. Like, it could be for bugs, for upgrades, but it's ultimately like the miner's decision with who is, you know, more correct. Like, if a fork happens, like, they're like, this chain is going to be more valuable, so we're going to go with that. And ultimately, they have to base their decision based on value because of the capital investment that they've already made.
But that's also only that's half of the picture, yes. And it would be more true without money. If it was a chain without the money value, it would just be the miners deciding whether that chain
is. Yeah, the developers still need to merge the code.
The exchanges, right? Mm. BTC became possible because they started to be listed. Otherwise, nobody would have cared.
I mean, in the case of the BTC, BCH split, basically the miners were defeated, right? The miners, certainly the majority of the miners wanted a block size upgrade. And, you know, the old will say we're dead and they couldn't get it, was the ultimate outcome.
Yeah, it's like a chain. It's like the miners do it based on profit, but it becomes legitimate based on if exchanges like adopt it. So it's like they're taking a risk that this is going to like bring them more profit, but it's like a gambling game. So you have to like figure out, okay, which path should we go?
So I'm hearing two things. One is, who are the stakeholders? So miners, developers, exchanges, who are
users.
Very important.
Yeah, well, it has a trajectory, and it's like path. It's like first it's the developers, and it's the miners, and it's like the exchanges, and it's the users, right? It's like the flow. It's like a...
It's flow. It's probably just like, it's a web of things that change each other.
Yeah.
I mean, if the developers see all this thing is highly, like...
Well, developers slash Twitter.
Sorry?
Like, you know, developers slash Twitter.
No, yeah,
course,
that's
like,
right. It's like,
yeah.
If there's sentiment, okay, this block upgrade is like, everybody thinks it's a bad thing, but we know it might be technically a good thing. Mm-hmm. Just because it's technically a good thing doesn't mean that everybody will adopt it.
It still
has to be merged.
When it is adopted then?
Which also then depends on exchanges and like the what other people say. I don't think there's clear. I mean, as far as like taxonomy, I think we the ones like hard fork, soft fork. I think we have to distinguish between like a technical taxonomy of just like the very technical dimension of what is actually happening in the if you were code, and then there's also like the social layer, right? Does the community actually split? Is there big overlap in community? Things like that.
Yeah, I mean, words hard fork and soft fork are almost not worth using in this discussion. They're a kind of a technical detail of how an upgrade is done. But I think what we're mainly talking about here is economic forks, right? We're talking about whether the community splits or the currency splits. So normally I would call that an economic fork when you end up with effectively two separate currencies. But then within economic forks there are, I guess, different motivations and different ways they
The thing is that you can do the fork soft fork.
You can do an economic fork also with a soft fork, because if you don't accept the soft fork and you lose the hash rate majority, if you don't accept the soft fork and you gain a hash rate majority, then you get an economic fork, right? And if you have a hard fork, you also get an economic fork.
But would you have two separate chains?
So a soft fork that results in two chains is kind of a failed soft fork in that it's a soft fork that doesn't get a hash rate majority. In that situation, I think this is right. You'll get two chains, assuming that some people continue with trying to do the upgrade even though it didn't get the mining majority. With a hard fork, you necessarily get two chains in the first place.
So is it something that was happening at the beginning? We haven't seen these economic forks in the last, I don't know, few months, year. Do you see something like this coming up in Ethereum or in Bitcoin or in any other?
I think the most interesting case is with Rybox, for example, or NAM or whatever. Then the developers are being sued because they did not fork. There's a class action lawsuit going on because an exchange got hacked and the developers decided to not fork and basically save these funds. That is sort of the, I would say, an economic not fork. And it's, I think that's, for me, one of the very interesting cases where governance and who's actually responsible for making deciding what are the exceptions that you can actually decide on. I think that's the sort of thing where it gets very interesting, because all of a sudden, because they don't have the governance system where you have clear distinction of who's responsible for this and this and this and how's the decision making process. They just have the developers themselves and cross-action losses basically on their hands, because they did not report.
So that's one of the questions when we are having the network effort. So say that we actually have one community that decides, and we are able to at least partially identify the stakeholders that are going to provide us with those answers, whether we want to have those actions or not. And if we lower the amount of barriers for forks, I think they call it zero barrier or zero fork, that means that there is plenty of options to create a lot of forks and split the community. And all of a sudden, we have more and more communities, but less and less stakeholders that are actually governing the whole system. But at the same time, I mean, that might actually be good because it brings a lot of diversity into the system. Who says that it's only good to have one community that is going to decide and all
the stakeholders? I don't think it's good. It's good to have an actual process of a place where you can say, okay, this is how we handle things, this is how we decide on exceptions and things like that.
So a higher threshold of certainty is better than to not really know who are the stakeholders and to just go with the flow.
No, just to have a process in place.
For elections.
For example,
elections.
It could be very simple election, say, okay, we elect 21 block producers, let's just say 21 for fun, who decides how basically the code is governed, etc. And then if there was a lawsuit, then these 21 people would basically be people who would have to deal with people coming to them and saying, okay, we think what you did was wrong. Based on that, what can you do for us, basically?
So that's another way of saying that we're creating, this is the problem with creating a process, and this is why ultimately you kind of have to have forking as the ultimate fallback, is that if you create a process, then that gives you a point of attack.
Yep.
So for crypto people, when we think of the government, you know, of a core thought theory to do something, we consider that an attack generally. But you could also think of it could be something, kidnap those guys or rape those guys. And any formalized process that you have brings in some kind of possibility of attacking it.
So if you think about it
compared to normal sort of forms of government, you can kind of think of the sort of the economic fork like a coup d'état as opposed to having a constitution, right? So when you change a constitution, you can have a kind of a formalized I don't know if this makes sense. You can have a formalized method of changing that constitution that gives you this one chain. And if everybody believes in that process, then you only ever get one clear center of power. But in some situations,
that's
when
like a soft fork.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Or it's built in.
But in some situations where that gets subverted, the ultimate fallback is always, we say, I'm not going to police, I'm not going to obey.
But that's assuming there is a culture in place. And that's
yes.
Not the case.
Like rough consensus is governance in itself, like it's just like a non like the choice is that we don't have a formal governance process, but like it's, that's why I think it is nice for something. I think it's also like you have a certain like use case in community, and like rough consensus might be adapted for something like Bitcoin, and that would be something we need, maybe make more something more formalized for something like to move like quicker or to have more clarity in certain theory process. For example, Bitcoin, like it doesn't move a lot. From what I understand, we don't have that many decisions to take daily, and so rough consensus is okay and it's complete, but it's like safer or in some way.
Yeah, one question that I have, for example, is do we want to create this process and formalize or maximize fork readiness to facilitate and help forks to happen, or do we want to avoid forks happening? Because I feel that an economic fork is always a traumatic experience. It has a risk, because the power of an economy is directly related to the amount of people embedded in it.
The community.
Just a sheer absolute weight of value embedded in that economy gives it resilience. A smaller economy is more manipulable. A smaller actor can have a heavy influence. It's easier to move the market by making it. So actually, scale, in my point of view, is now stepping out of a subsidiary of being a participant and having an opinion. Scale is a good thing. We should aim for scale, and economic forking is a dangerous gambit. Like, what is it doing classic today? Yeah. And they just got 51% a few months ago.
Nobody cared.
Nobody gave a fuck. At least in our community.
There was nothing lost.
Is there anything left?
I think it didn't affect it financially that much.
Not at all, actually.
Yeah.
But I would support that we should be asking, okay, what direction do we even want to regulate?
So do we want more force or less?
The question is, what is the target of that process, or is there protection of what? Developers, as you brought up, right, against class actions,
for example,
or coin holders, or miners, or exchanges. They all have their investments, and who are we going to protect with this procedure, or maybe non-procedure, because that can be attacked. I don't agree with the basic premise you just said about the traumatic experience to the economy, and that it has to be as big as possible. So I think there's probably a lot of untapped potential in the technology that right now might be held back by the stability that's being enforced by the economic interests.
I know, but that's the polarity that has to be negotiated.
Yeah.
And so that's why the upgrade fork, the ideal, like, do we want to be conservative or do we want to move forward? And I think what I'm trying to get, I'm starting to see, is that there is an invisible fork line embedded in a community where if we approach that line, there's the incentive for the split starts to grow. And if anything, what we should do is create mechanisms to make this fork line visible and make people make sense around the fork line.
So predictable.
Well, just get people to talk about it. It's a good idea. Like, what is the moment where?
But this is why I brought up
interests of miners that we're not quite up with ETC. It's Bitcoin maximalists attacking Ethereum. That is probably part of the picture. So why do forks even happen at all? And also this other fact that I feel lots of technicians actually stay on the fence. They go either way. You're not even too vocal. They don't have this kind of opinion. You might have an opinion about block size and so on, right? What's better? But the driving factors behind forks should probably be on the table, and maybe then the whole thing becomes a very simple story.
So that's what I thought is being clear in Ethereum, because I thought that proof of stake is always going to be on the table. So the miners knew what they're going into from the whole beginning.
Yeah, proof of stake is not coming because of the miners. The time bomb was not built out to please the miners.
Okay.
It was taken back because technologically it's not there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is Ethereum doing right now, like, to get ready for the fork? How are they communicating to the miners, to the community? What's the plan? Do they have a plan?
Ethereum 2.0 is technically ready?
Like, the presentations that we were listening to was like, how do we, if there is going to be a new idea of a suggestion for the upgrade of the software, what is going to be the governance, what are the rules, how to discuss within the community, who can actually make a suggestion when the decision is made?
On forking?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a pure power play, right? It's the Wild West, so guys with the most power win, and that's why I'm bringing up exchanges as arbiters of whether it's going to be having any value on it.
I think there's kind of a change that we're going to see increasingly with Ethereum as we interact more with the rest of the world. Because with Bitcoin, you've got a currency which is just a meme, right, basically. It's just a number. And it kind of, if there were two of them, it kind of doesn't matter, except to the extent, I mean, how much of it have you got? It's all you care about. But what we see with Ethereum is that now we've got DAI. And DAI is supposed to be $1, right? So DAI will not cleanly fork, probably. If you've got a DAI which is supposed to be pegged to $1, it's pegged using Ether on that chain. If you then fork that chain, then one of three things can happen. One is that only one chain will have DAI that's still worth $1, and the other one will be worth $0. So that's just kind of blown up your whole forking governance backstop system, because the minority, even if they're correct, no longer have a functioning stable coin, which has just exploded, you know, huge swathes of other contracts at this point. So that's bad. Maybe weirdly, if it's exactly balanced, you could end up with $1 being $2, $1 each chain, which would be kind of great, unless you're a collateral holder, in which case it's kind of terrible. Or potentially they might both go to zero. Firstly, those are all kind of bad outcomes. So once we've got DAI, we can't just split the community in the way that we could at the time of the ETH/ETC fork. It's going to, you know, wreak all kinds of havoc.
Don't tell them, guys.
But then the second problem is, who actually has the power to decide where DAI goes? Well, probably the guys who are publishing the main oracle. And that's a fairly small number of people, and they now have all this power. Effectively, whichever side the maker oracle goes, that side's going to win. So now we do have a process, we do have a group of people, we do have the people you sue, the people who control the maker oracle basically control this chain, which Ethereum chain wins. So we can all go home. We don't have any choice anymore.
This
Wouldn't
is a really good point.
Yeah, the maker oracle is basically a bunch of people signing sort of exchanges, or are they as well as it? I'm not sure if it's exchanges or if it's kind of trusted parties.
Yes.
And then
there's kind of one of them they're on, and there's other like exchanges on.
Yeah.
Other like price feeds.
Yeah, but you're basically needing these signed price feeds.
But again, you have this pattern of the outside value
feed,
the exchanges, or being the case the oracle.
Right.
Feeding in the outside value,
carrying
the day.
And then going forward, the next thing that happens is that we're trying to change the world, we're not trying to make memes, right? So if we're trying to interact with the outside world, then you want to say, okay, I want to insure my house, right? I want to control the deeds of who owns my house on a blockchain. When it was Bitcoin and when it was Ether, we could just split, and then you'd have two Ether, or well, one Ether on the one ETC, or two Bitcoins, right? Two kinds of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But I've only got one physical house, so when we split the chain, we can't split my house. So where we were able to kind of equivocate, the world now has to decide on one. And that then means that there are all these internal and external actors, often potentially regulated actors as well, who now have control over which one do they set. When I say, I own this house, you don't own this house, and I get the court to enforce, you know, the fact that I can live in the house and you can't live in the house, then you've got an external court deciding which is the way to hear.
Well, this is also the thing with the class action lawsuits, exactly that, because there was no process in place where it could agree beforehand.
Yeah.
So basically, the outside courts have to decide, okay, what is like, right, are we going to do this?
Yeah.
And the enforcement after will be even more messy.
Yeah.
And it goes in the same direction.
Yeah. And the other thing that the Just dropped with, which applies to Bitcoin as well, is that the IRS finally announced their view of how you pay taxes on forked coins. And what the IRS said, which I think is technically correct but has all kinds of nasty impact, is that when you get a new currency appears, you have to pay taxes on that asset that you just acquired. So now the IRS is going to decide which is the pre-existing chain and which is the new fork chain. And they're going to make you to pay taxes on the new fork chain.
I think we have the same situation, actually.
Yeah,
In our case, the argument against taxing the new chain was that
right. You
get the coins and you don't even know that you got them.
Right.
So sometimes they would be even just delivered to your address, and we actually made an argument.
Yeah.
We made an argument because we know some of the people that work for tax authorities, and they do have addresses.
Right.
We're just saying, hey, we're gonna pump a lot of tokens into your account, and then you tax yourself if you're into it so much. But yeah, they are going to be the ones deciding on which chain is going to remain.
That's an awesome way to bribe people without having to go tax yourself.
With taxes. but okay, so this kind of sounds like we are already having third parties that are deciding on our behalf, so we are kind of having a mediation process in place, or like just adopting the court systems.
Well, because there's no other process.
Exactly, yeah.
But also, they might not care what we decide.
Right.
I mean, how it might be actually much easier to just go with an existing court system and say, okay, you be the ones deciding, but there's plenty of different court systems in the world. So we don't really just have courts in many jurisdictions and then international courts for specific legal issues. We also have different organizations like WTO and health organizations, and they all have their own dispute mechanisms. So if we want to become much more independent, it seems to me as if we want that we will need to establish our own dispute mechanisms, so that we are the ones deciding which chain is the correct one and which not.
And actually addressing those issues, because those were the debates we had with like a workshop yesterday on the legal and Ethereum, also what Vitalik was saying, what Vlad was saying. So like if we're not going to take care of our own rules, some other organizations or institutions are going to come in and say, okay, this is the right thing.
Yeah, but then who decides who is going to be that institution? I mean, we are not talking about the American ones, but...
And also, who do you decide, who are the stakeholders?
Yeah.
What do you mean by we need to decide what we...
Exactly, that's a really good question. Like, who is the community? Who are the players? Who are the stakeholders again? Like, is it Ethereum magicians? Is it like the, I don't know, the foundation?
I think that in terms of stakeholders, you can make a differentiation between so there are indirect stakeholders, there are the world in general, and it's the other, this part, I think, to include, the same thing that we're trying to do. I don't know, when you know it's about, including the river, or giving it a ride to a river to have some voice into some organization and stuff. I think that's the very tricky part that is not solved yet. I think in the blockchain space we have these organizations a group of stakeholders that is specific to it. For example, in the case of Bitcoin, it's miners and users and developers.
mainly miners and users actually, because like without developers, the protocol can live from now. Like from the moment it's like implemented, it's not perfect, it can live. But miners and users are the like, contributors, stakeholders, the two groups that are like essential for the protocol to be. Like without users, like the value goes to zero, and without miners, the value goes to zero. And so you have this first like first group of stakeholders that really has the power. I mean, yeah. Developers are also like very important.
It can go to zero without developers too, because it's not scalable. So
yeah, I mean, it can go to zero, but it can like, I mean, it can without users, it will go like to absolute zero. If without developers, I can you can still have some use with
if
the.
If you have too many users and no developers, then that kind of.
I mean, if you have like a community of miners securing the network, it's very secure, and you have users like using Ethereum as a store of value. I mean.
No.
It's still a value in the user.
It won't scale. Like if,
I mean,
if
won't
the users
scale,
go up and the developers go
it's
away.
Still like, it, maybe some other network will scale, but maybe this network won't scale.
Sorry,
scale.
I didn't mean like scale. Just like you won't be able to like use it. Like so, if you can't use it, then
you
the value
can,
go away.
If you
what?
Don't have a problem with paying a transaction like $100 to have buy like a 20k Bitcoin because it's very secure.
I mean, are you saying that if like the number of transactions in Ethereum today was like 1,000 times and no one's like touching any of the code, like is it still going to work? Like are people still going to use it because of how
I'm not very, I say, talking about like practical, more like an abstract way of this like distinction between like who are the stakeholders that are giving value to the network and profiting from the network directly. It's not the case of like developers have an interest into the network, that, or you could consider in some way like the holders of the coin or so then like they provide development work to the network and they're, you know, they have like a stake in the network. But actually like, yeah, I see this like very close relationship with the, only within miners and users who really have this, I give value and I take value from the network and that's an obvious relationship. I mean, developer could be included, but I think that's.
Okay. I see, and I can answer that. I don't agree, but it's good you pointing to this, these groups, because I think on the one hand the miners are kind of non-elected, right, metaphorically. On the other hand, the developers are actually to a very strong degree the ones who still call the shots. And they're also kind of not, there's no representation in a sense, but they still take the whole technology stack in the direction that they like, that they find important. Just to be blunt, I think a lot of the navel-gazing that's typical of Silicon Valley is also happening in the blockchain space, of course, so developers are addressing more like the problems they are interested in, right? Not so much non-developer things. So
yeah,
that's
like
very strong, I think, even when there's no fork, right? Or even when there's not an economic fork, but just
mm-hmm.
a hard fork that adds new features, but that shuts other doors, that this feature is not going to keep open. So it's good. I think I don't agree that developers are such an important group here, but I agree with the agrees that
it's kind of like saying like you know like Aragon would be fine without like flock teams or just users or just the network.
No,
you know,
I'm
talking about
developers.
I think for anything to have value, that's like technology. Like there's always going to have to be the people that are like. Improving and upgrading.
Okay.
And like,
yeah, but I definitely agree with you, like what you were saying. A very important group today. But like, if you were to take, so say, like no other protocol in the history of the you know, society would be created from now on, and developers these everywhere to tomorrow, and all we have left is like the Bitcoin protocol in the current state. Will we never use it? Will it, you know, now, like it can still work and will still have value. But if users disappear, no value. If miners disappear, no value. But if developers disappear, but I agree that in market, like where you can create a big, better protocol, like winner takes all, like yeah, goes to zero.
That's an interesting extreme. I think if all the core developers decide that there are no longer improvements out of the code, a lot of users would just switch.
Yeah, that's in the case of like an open market where like you would have some other protocol that would take their.
This is really great discussion.
What about transparency? So we kind of know
where and how the core developers are discussing. We can listen to their calls. But what about miners? Do we know anything about miners? Do we know this community?
It's a question to identify them. We just see the transaction going, but we like as signals, we try to gather the sentiment of different stakeholders in the Ethereum community to kind of see which EAPs are supported by which groups. And one of the proposals was to change the protocol in a way that miners would kind of somehow switch somewhere and indicate that they're in the favor of the CEP or not. That's the only way we totally know that this amount of power is for the CEP or not. But this wasn't implemented, it still is not planned even to be implemented. And otherwise, they asked, like on the when they discussed the fee reduction, they asked like three miners to the call, one major, one medium, and one small. They tried to talk during this like 1 hour and a half, 2 hours, but then they didn't invite them for the further calls. They kind of just got their opinion, but it wasn't continued over time to, you know, to develop these solutions together. So it's still a challenge.
Okay, what about mining pools? Like, there were some attempts also to tax or to tax mining pools, I think especially in China. Rivera was talking about it in her book. When we are talking about how independent or how autonomous a blockchain is and if we can actually stop it or not. And I think having an access to miners or mining pools is very important also from this point of view.
But it can also be dangerous for those miners. Yeah. If we start identifying them, that could undermine the whole idea of miners being anonymous, you know.
Exactly. But I mean, we know that mining pools are a reality, like how decentralized it actually is.
We know how centralized it actually is. So,
I mean, it's sort of like the cyberspace dream where all of a sudden, like, everybody said, oh, this internet is going to be so great and it's going to be attached from all, like.
Everybody's going to run their own mail
server. Exactly, everybody's going to run their own mail server, everybody's going to have the infrastructure, but the reality is, like, in the end, you still rely on national power grids and things like that. So it's like, if somebody wants to tax you, like, China decides to tax its miners, and there's nothing they can be able to do it. They might move somewhere else, but that's exactly the thing. It's like, if we don't provide like mechanisms to make this space sort of legible for a state, then the state is just going to come in and say, okay, this is what we need to make this space legible for us. There might be taxes, this might be regulation, whatever. That's
so
sort of the.
Do we need to have a conversation with the regulators?
Oh, I mean, most certainly. I don't see.
It almost seems like we always go with the dream that goes into the extreme. So also when you mentioned the internet, right? We wanted to dream of having a completely decentralized internet, but it didn't really end up being completely centralized. And same happened with the blockchain. But when you compare it to what was historically the previous thing that we had, it's much more decentralized than what we had before. So with the internet, for example, we had, well, okay, yeah, you might argue actually against it. I would love to hear the argument. With, for example, the internet, what I see is that we had radio and television and the newspapers. And there were just a certain amount of people that was providing the information. And with the internet, we got so much more of the people that are now capable of providing that information. Same goes with the blockchain. You only had the banks, and now all of a sudden you have different cryptocurrencies, you have different wallets, you have different entry points. And yes, of course, there are barriers, but at least we have an alternative. So it might still become a bit more decentralized.
I mean, I totally agree. It's just, like I said, if a state decides to intervene, then there's not much you'll be able to do. So that's why I think the most important thing is to sort of make this thing legible for a state so that they can understand sort of like. And if they want to tax us, then give them the tools to.
What's interesting about the state and the taxes is that the state itself is actually a decentralized mechanism, and it is more decentralized than the kings were previously.
Yeah, of course.
So if you read the history of how the states and nation states were actually created, it's pretty much the decentralization of whatever the power dynamics were before that. So
I wouldn't say it's decentralized more. I think it's
states are much more like, well, I just read Seeing Like a State, the book. I mean, it's a great book on legibility, like how did you actually go from like kings to states? And it's like, okay, you as a king want to understand, okay, who is actually living in the white domain? So you start going out, counting people, seeing what they do, and things like that. It's like making the thing legible, making the subject legible for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can raise more taxes, things like that. You can,
it's always about taxes.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, taxes is like money makes them work around, at least for folks in the future, I would say. So.
But we do have some institutions like checks and balances and like the differentiation of different powers in the state. So that would be kind of an idea of decentralization that Anya was telling about before. But yeah, I mean, at the end, it's like going back to the topic governance. Like,
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the state, whatever the state is, will make this blockchain thing legible for the state. Whatever that might mean, okay, in China or in Europe, you might have said, okay, you have to register as a miner if you want to like operate as a miner. Might also just mean you can just continue as a miner and nobody gives a shit because the state just doesn't see it's important enough to spend its resources on like dealing with this because it's just not important. But I think if we ourselves don't deal with like exactly these sort of like governance problems of making this, like these processes understandable, then somebody else will come and make them come from the outside and say, okay, we need to understand this because you developers did not save the money of like 20 people which is around $200 million. Why? And then they will make legislation and just impose it upon you. And you can decide if it's better to sort of say we as a community sort of try to figure out these processes, or we wait for somebody else from the outside and just come and look at it and say, okay, this is also how it's going to work.
But also, have you noticed that one of the sponsors of DevCon is at the University?
Yeah.
They were almost dead last year when they published the tweet that they are out of funds and they can't develop it further. But then Afri is now working with them and they got like two investors. And they now are seeing the collaboration between Ethereum 1 and Ethereum Classic because they can develop the same software tooling. And I think in the future we might prepare for the complexity and like DevCon 12 have 7 different Ethereum versions and still community coming. And some, like for example, there would be an unsuccessful version of Ethereum but still traded on exchanges.
Say something to that, because actually what Ethereum project tries to do is try to rejoin.
Yeah.
They want to be the watch carriers of Ethereum 1x when the main Ethereum port goes to 2.0. If that's going to happen or not, I don't know, but it's interesting that there's also this urge, obviously, to be
reunited.
Yeah. So wherever that comes from.
Why do you think this is so? Like,
to remain relevant, I think. Because
it sounds very human right? Yeah. Human motivations. Just like in the end, the fork for ideal reform reason, I guess. I don't know.
And that's something actually reminds me of. It's the Ares fork, which was one of the first forks where somebody. Now that's Monex now. A long time ago, they forked Ethereum and said, so we're going to create the economic version or the business version of Ethereum. And then they actually started to alter stuff, and then they took it all back because they couldn't keep up with the pace of Ethereum itself developing. So they made themselves compatible again until they basically rejoined the main stream. So. That's also interesting. So there's obviously a force that brings you back to the table.
We actually talked about it last night. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with the word balkanization?
Yeah.
Okay. Can anybody explain it? Because I mean, we have one version of it because we come from the Balkan, so it might not be the right one.
Yeah, like the rest of the world thinks it's a bad thing that you're now independent.
I don't know.
Obviously, what else can it mean?
I mean, so in a way, Balkanization, that means that it's a fragmentation of a big state. Right, so it was a federation before, and then all of a sudden there was a notion that all states gained the independence and became sovereign. Which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, although we do hear our parents and our grandparents talk about how Yugoslavia was so much better, and that's a...
No, I think
Balkanization was more of like the supposed like needless fracturing of the greater whole.
Supposedly independent, right? It's a loaded word. Why is it loaded? I mean, we have to overcome that first, right? It doesn't make sense to use that load that brings with it that is critical of becoming independent as a unit that might make much more sense.
I guess we coined that term presumably when it was fracturing and resulting in a huge war, right? Mm-hmm. Which to us quite a confusing war with various different countries.
I don't even know how that was coined.
Maybe it was before. But
the opposite of that was Prison of Nations. That's how the Austrian Empire was called.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's funny about it is that we were sovereign and independent for a couple of years, and then we joined the European Union. So we never really were a sovereign and independent state, as in not being connected to a greater whole.
Okay, let me explain.
So this is why I think that what we were discussing before, the fragmentation and all the forks, and then all of them uniting and coming back together, I think that's a very natural process.
So you have a subset discussion?
We're kind of comparing this to like building your own company or building your own new state. When you're forking, maybe if you think about forking the DAO, I can copy-paste DAO and make it or work. I don't know. The idea would be kind of different. Actually, I think when was it? I think it was in March. There were some colleagues saying, oh, we should fork MakerDAO. So that would be interesting. And how would...
That is actually going forward.
Is it?
Yeah, there are some people working it. That's all I have to say.
That's it? Can you update?
Somebody's interested...
Is that a software fork, or is it an attempt to actually take all the existing collateral holders?
Well, disintermediate the mechanism of Maker, right? Because, for example, as you have something been done about the key attack that Rune performed, or in the last few months, or are we still? Because after you,
I think they just took care of it, like internally.
I think you just won. And the thing is, after you explained the importance of DAI, which I actually don't have enough financial education to understand my own, so thank you. I'm like, fuck. Let's look into that room thing again.
I mean, to be fair, it's not that important yet, but that's where everything seems to be heading. Every app wants to have a stable coin, and the winning stable coin is DAI, so everything is going to be DAI.
I think it's very important.
Sorry. Okay, educate us on the attack. I don't know.
So basically, it was a multisig of seven people, and he basically physically and psychologically forced his partners to give him the keys, and now he holds all the keys of the liquor multisig. Yeah. It's a documented
dictatorship.
It's a documented like real life attack. It's online. There's like pages and pages of leaked memos from inside. It was a process that was happening about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And now he can do what?
Well, he has all the billions of funds of Maker at his command. He is the CEO of his company, and he wants it's good. But
but specifically, he can control the price feeds that he uses, or
no? He controls the entire multisig, so he can withdraw the funds if he wants. He can fuck off his.
He should be able to leave.
Well, what was the system before? So there were different people
before,
that had
to... Before, it was decentralized, or at least the name.
No.
There were seven people,
so
decentralized.
I mean, it's not that much of a difference.
Do you know how it works in Ethereum?
People influence themselves so much that they are actually having physical attacks.
It's not that much of a difference. No. As long as the seven people agree, constantly, there's no difference.
Exactly. I mean, for him, it is easier.
When do seven people agree constantly? I've never seen it.
For the same purpose, if the home is on fire, we could agree to a draw.
So the key word there is constantly.
Yeah.
The question would be, is this the access to funds of MakerDAO, or is this access to funds that
I'm not prepared to answer the question, but I will run a deep research.
This is not at all the backup type. Maybe is it the emergency hall that's also connected to that?
That's figured out. That was...
The money the company has, right? Or the money that's in the contract.
About forking Maker. Sorry, guys, I was too late. I didn't know which part of the subject
you are. Maybe you can join us here.
I'm chunky to get there. I'll be here. There is this theory that we can evolve things until they get perfect. But there is the Darwinism. So if a lot of people fork the project, some will survive, and some will mutate, and some will eventually evolve by birth and death of project. So these are two conflicting philosophies, and we don't have a say which is better, but we humans are from the right side. So basically we are forks of each other, that we die based on capacity of survival. So this might be a good thing for software as well.
Pretty long process though.
Yeah.
Well, talking software doesn't take that long.
Yeah.
You can do it fast.
No, but you could say that you have generations of software.
Why, definitely.
Yeah.
There's versioning.
I think there's a kind of a sort of the way my thoughts evolved about this. Like originally, when I was using Bitcoin, looking at smart contracts, I thought that we were making a machine. I thought the model was a mechanical model, where what you're trying to do, and if you read the Nick Szabo stuff, that's kind of the idea that you have this machine that you're going to put something in, and it's going to follow these determined steps, and then something's going to happen. So, and if you got a machine, in theory, it can just run forever. But then when I started looking at things like prediction markets, where there's this problem of parasite, you know, if you have a prediction market system that's reliant on having a certain number of token holders, if there are too many users of this system, then it becomes insecure. And there's this problem that occurs all over the place in crypto economics, where I started to think that these unchanging mechanical systems are actually not sustainable, and that you have something that's more like a biological system, where you've got a bunch of actors that are continually evolving, and if they don't continually evolve, then they're going to die. So if you have an animal that allows itself to be parasitized...
Are you technical?
Yes.
You are. So, I mean, think of the basic structure of how DNA works, right?
Right.
So you can change that.
Right.
You can change a lot of what is programmed in the DNA, but if you want to change that basic structure underneath, you break everything.
Yeah.
So I think that's where, on the whole, blockchain went becoming too complex, because the original vision makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Then you have to create something that's super simple that you don't have to change anymore. And then you have a layer on top of that where you can have this biological development, so to say. Mm-hmm. And then maybe every 10 years you also say, change that layer underneath, but it's going to be less controversial. We have that all merged into one, which way I think Ethereum got a lot more complex than planned. Even Bitcoin, probably, was in the beginning much more simple, and through that, safer. So I think maybe it's just, it happened that way, and maybe that's also a good aspect about when we talk about forking. Is there maybe a proposition to be made that maybe stuff should be separated into layers, so we have a different discussion about what a fork means and when it is necessary, and how it might be then very clear that a certain fork is really just about the economic aspects and another fork.
I mean that was part of the controversy of the DAI fork, I guess, was that you had the EVM underneath, and the assumption was that most people would probably have agreed that if there was a bug in the EVM, and that it was possible to, firstly you have to fix that bug, but also if it was then possible to take some recovery actions for contracts that had suffered from that bug in the EVM, then that's something that people would want to do. And the analogy has happened in Bitcoin, you know, on multiple occasions, where for example there was an overflow and there were Bitcoins that were issued that shouldn't have been issued, and nobody said, well, those Bitcoins have got to remain after there was an overflow, right? Everybody said, okay, we'll fix it and we'll put it back to where it should have been. But the controversy with the DAO rescue was that the bug was in a contract built on top of the EVM. The EVM functioned correctly. However, it was built on a contract on top of the EVM but also all our documentation was wrong. Right? So if you were coding, if you read ethereum.org and you were using the EVM in the kind of the commonly accepted way, you may still have hit that bug. So it seems like from the point of view of a user, it's almost a distinction without a difference that the EVM is working correctly. But from my point of view, if I do what I'm supposed to do to make the EVM function, I still get hit. So that's, I think, part of where that controversy went, that some people said, no, look, the EVM is correct, so leave it alone. And other people said, look, from the user's point of view, it may as well have been wrong, so we need to fix it. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's I don't think that's really happened.
Okay, yeah. But I guess the question is then, are the kind of sustainable layers about what you're going to say isn't going to change and what is going to change? And I definitely think that's a good conversation. And so the practical example is that we discovered fairly early on that gas prices change. And to me, it's always been an assumption as a developer that gas prices will change. But apparently a lot of people didn't get that memo, right? So now it looks like we need to change the gas prices to allow us to scale Ethereum, because it turns out that writing data to the chain is too cheap now, and also reading data from the chain is too cheap. But then computational operations, for example, are too expensive in comparison.
So would it help, from what you just said, would it help to have a clarification for all the users and whomever the stakeholder is? What are the possible changes that can be made?
Yes.
And then having them all listed.
Yes.
And then next to that, how hard it is to change one of them, or what it takes. Because to me, it almost seems like we also have these constitutions and the governmental, all the states are running based on laws, but not all laws can be changed in a simple way.
Yeah.
And you have the constitution, which has a higher threshold, because it should be changed as little as possible, and as less frequency as possible. And then you have the bylaws that are changing very fast, and can be changed very severely, based on what the interest of the administration is.
Yeah.
And here it's pretty much the same. I mean, the gas is going to change just like the administration bylaws.
Right.
While the EV, the Ethereum virtual machine, is not going to change very fast and often.
Right.
We don't really want it to be changed as often, because it's the layer zero. So the more layers we build, it almost seems like we're creating this hierarchy of all these layers. And then the highest layer is probably going to be what we are operating with day by day, and can be changed according to what we need on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't quite fit the gas example, because the gas prices are in the EVM, they're EVM detail, like a lowest layer detail. But so it may be that it doesn't actually quite correspond to the protocol layers, but I do think that there's kind of an implicit understanding about certain things that are kind of guaranteed to be Ethereum, and other things that kind of aren't quite guaranteed. And that information, I think, is very badly shared. And then on a practical level, there are a bunch of things that are going to change in Ethereum 2. And the Ethereum 2 protocol developers kind of implicitly generally know that, but everybody else doesn't know that. And there's definitely a concrete communication failure there about, firstly, what is the implicit understanding that we try not to change? The gas prices doesn't count, but the fact that you can store something does count. And secondly, in practice, what is going to change in future? That information obviously wants to be circulated and shared as soon as possible.
You wanted to ask something.
Yeah, you were speaking about clarifying the information, right? This is a good effort, I agree, but I've seen a lot of places where people know what is a constant, know what is a variable, but when a variable changes every 2 years, 5 years, or change just a small amount, and people don't even feel it, even knowing the difference between a variable and a constant, they treat a variable like a constant. Like, you don't mind the plate movements when you're flying from United States to Europe. The distance is changing every year, but you treat it as a constant. there's no problem in that. But what happened with gas price is that it remains a like constant for a lot of time, it changes. If it's possible to do this movement gradually and more constant, probably you don't even need to clarify better. People will know that this is a variable, and we will, with no change, treat this a constant, just without no effort of communication.
But do you expect that this will lead to a fork?
Possibly. Possibly, not very probable, but...
I don't think so, because, I mean, it is a major change, right? It's going to break contracts that work now. And still, I think the expectation is, yeah, it's going to be understood as a technical, necessary security change. There's no economic interest riding on it, so it's probably not going to result.
I think that it looks like it probably won't happen the way it was intended, but there was a plan for state rent, which would have broken a lot of contracts and really broken kind of the reasoning behind those contracts. And I think that if the core developer team had tried to roll that out, I think there would have been a new economic fork. And
I don't think it for should happen, but imagine a very badly written contract with like hard-coded amount of gas being flow that will simply stop working after the update, and you don't have a proxy. The only way to run that code would be on an older version, or if you do some workaround.
No,
so it's possible.
Payments, default payment cost gonna break.
Yeah,
because it's just gonna, you know, be above the threshold. So yeah, a lot of stuff's gonna break.
Yeah, and it's possible that people that like this stuff that's gonna break should keep on our versions or do some work around. I just think that's possible.
Yeah.
But my point is that because there's no money riding on it, right? It's not like the DAO, people want to get their money re-unlocked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot less dangerous. And I think that's important.
But if you got money in actual contracts and those contracts have broken, then it's definitely about money, right?
Yes, but it doesn't sound like it. Otherwise you would hear more alarms.
I think that at least the current one, the current gas pricing will probably not.
Although it's
the state rate.
Although it's a severe hurting change. But I think I think that's important because these traumatic events, I think, only happen if there's money locking. Mm-hmm. Right? If somebody is set to regain or have their assets frozen, depending on the fork happening or not. And I think that should inform the whole idea about, okay, what are we even discussing?
I don't think either the BCH fork or the BSV fork really follow that.
Well, it's only money either. It's like, let's say...
It was money to be earned.
Blockchain games take off big time, and then all of a sudden there's a fork, and my favorite blockchain game is always on one fork, and it's not supported by the company on the other fork. I don't care about the money, I just want to play my game.
Yeah,
I
agree.
But are we aware that this could actually happen? That you can lose a part of your whatever you're doing activities because of a fork?
No, it's not so much part of the activity, but saying, okay, you as a company chose this one fork. I might personally, for whatever reason, choose the other fork. And then there's like a discrepancy just because before it worked, and now it doesn't work anymore, and there's no money involved, it's just yeah. And there might then again be economic incentive, okay, if there's enough interest in both forks, then the company might say, okay, we support both forks, or whatever it is.
So we've copy-pasted the systems that we are having currently, because like, there's a lot of people that would simply delete Facebook, but they never do, because we have groups of people, and we have Messenger, and it's simply not... None other app exists that would allow me to migrate everything that I have on Facebook to that app that would function better and would not sell my data and would treat my data better and would not breach my privacy and stuff like that. So what I thought is possible with blockchain and having the permissionless systems is that we are creating a system where these migrations are going to be much more possible and plausible. And now what you're saying is that because of the fork, we are actually back in
What I'm saying is that, yes, you might still be able to play your game on the old fork, but there will. I mean, if the company decides to just adopt the other fork and
there are some
breaking changes, then they just might not be able for you to play the new game. I don't know, maybe there's a new item and you won't be able, your friend will be able to get this new item.
Yeah,
when talking about Facebook, it's like it's code, but it's also the network effect. So
yeah, of course.
Is it like is it more like in the future? Are there forks more likely to happen or less likely to happen in comparison to the past? I mean, because like the network is going to be bigger, we are kind of used to how Ethereum works, we are using it, there are more and more. Yeah.
In the case of Ethereum?
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, you guys like know more than me about Ethereum and the specific types.
Like stable?
Yeah, like Casper Labs isn't like the fork of Ethereum, can we say that? What did they do?
In a way,
I see like tens of forks of Ethereum, Near protocol, everybody's working on scalability and so on. So they basically take, and even Libra have taken part of the Ethereum protocol, right? So it's already happening, I think there will be more and more.
Yeah,
but these are not really hard forks, right?
Yeah.
These are community.
No, no, not even that. It's just like it's just using the code base. So it's like fork of Ethereum.
Yeah,
it's a software. It's
yeah.
a software.
So
yeah.
in a way, that's like I'm having a branch of a company.
Sorry.
Having like a branch of a company.
No, no just using the.
It's just using a library, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It's like it's just using
the code.
I think the more interesting thing is just where
so
actually
fork technically, right? It is a technical. It's a developer term, and what it means is you part ways. Necessarily with the community or so, but you start to develop code that's not the same anymore as like what's here, what's developed here, and then you lose the synergy you might have if you stay closer together.
Well, in that sense, it's more a fork in the protocol, like in the,
yeah,
not so much in the software. The software might be completely different, as long as it's using the same protocol, it doesn't matter.
I mean,
for example, taking
Ethereum
and Parity, two different
aspects. I get it, but they were not a fork. Right?
No, that was not that's what I mean, like they're completely different software, but they still speak the same
language. Yeah, but I'm talking about like GitHub fork.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Fork it, and you might, actually on GitHub it might mean you don't even change anything. It just means like you make a copy of this thing, and that is ready to develop in a different direction for some reason. And often for merging it back, right? The technical term just means that. So when you talk of Ethereum forks, that means not necessarily they change much or they change a lot or whatever, but they usually have a reason and they don't necessarily take away the community of Ethereum, right? Because they start something new, but technically it's still a fork because they use the code base of Ethereum as a starting point.
But for, like, is it like, would you consider like, for example, like, so you can take ETB, and basically a fork in the protocol. I would consider that pretty different from, like, for example, Libra reusing part of the code base to do something completely different and like not forking a version or whatever.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, that's you forking the repo if you want, like, and using some components. You can, that, but like here we're like it's portable. Like, what is being mined?
It's basically the version of the state. And
yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to wrap it out. Unless you have any other questions or comments,
we have a lot of questions here.
Yeah.
Should
we summarize?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of questions, and I actually think that we managed to got the answers to some of them. There's 22 questions, but altogether, this is my name.
Give it to me. I can keep.
That's okay. So my understanding is much better now regarding the course, especially the DAI that was an interesting case. And yeah, I think I would actually love to go with a table that has four quadrants and just find out whether we can formalize the taxonomy of forks and write it and have like a better understanding through a visual representation of it. Should we do a circle?
Yeah.
You feel good about it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Go for it.
Well, I think we should have had paper and pens and be more actionable and less paper oriented.
Yeah,
okay.
This is most of it, but I enjoyed the part I took. I don't know. I can go.
I think we would have done better if we had more constraints.
I never thought about the form problem before, to be honest. I kind of felt that, for example, Ethereum Foundation is kind of responsible for maintaining the brand and the meme, you know, and the chain. So I know that, like, when the DAO fork was there, they did some communication, they launched the voting, and so on. So I think they have at least some level of understanding how to react, and it improves over time. And I'm not sure our users, like if, when you said, like we need to be responsible for what's in that, I'm not sure users would care enough to participate in that. Or that, like, they can join the Ethereum Foundation communication team or something. But that's like we have the faculty, we can't follow everything, so we just would find ourselves in some time again in a situation having to change and just selecting what we will find legit. But I found the conversation really interesting, and there's a like first for me and the start of this dialogue in general.
Listening to some of your exchanges, partly like also like glimpses of like technical discussions, because I mean we'll talk about work from our own perspectives and stuff, tend to think like more like higher social system level or whatever. But like one thing I understood also, like because we haven't even chatted about like you know, governance models and where is rough consensus, where are the reasons, these good aspects, bad aspects, where it can work, how maybe can more formalized models can. So what I'm trying to understand why like people in Ethereum people like tend to say that for the formal governance process is very hard to implement, because there are these new kinds of attacks and stuff, and because like basically as soon as you formalize something, the amount of complexity, when you were mentioning like that you have to consider like a national electricity grid, into the you know the way your different mapping different stakeholders that maybe have to be taken into account in the influence that they have, and how like in the governance model you have to take all the influences that stakeholders have in the network, and it's super hard to do. So yeah, I'm trying to, it seems for like really understand like the complexity of that part. Very interesting.
Yeah, I feel, I learned a lot. Thanks a lot. That's great ideas. Feel for the next iteration of this, it would be I would be coming back to the initial questions I had, like who do we think for, who do we want to provide for. I have my ideas, but that is a group thing, I think. But yeah, great start. I think there was a lot of stuff on Earth. It would be great to somehow keep track of it.
To me, it was very interesting, and especially the part with the stakeholders. So who do we need to address? How are the like power play between those different organizations or non-organizations? And I mean, if we have a feeling that this is something that is actually thought through, or it's just happening, or it's just something that it's like a combination of different things, like some person that is very charismatic, or like convincing a group of like a community, which community, how this interacts together. So yeah, just like opening a whole bunch of